anguish made her angry. He was supposed to be helping her, not the other way about. Curious Londoners had emerged from shops and houses to see the crash. She could feel their eyes on her scalp, and although she could not hear what they were muttering to one another, she could guess. "Come on," she told Kit. "It's not far to Godtalk's Head." "I must get back to Ludgate Hill," he said, swaying as he pushed himself away from the wrecked chair. "The children!" Fever caught him, drew his arm across her shoulders, and did her best to take his weight. "You can't! Not now! Those other chairs!" She could already hear the weary thud of running feet behind them. "Come on, Master Solent, please," she begged. And slowly, 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 they went on along the street. Chapter 19. Dr. Crumb. Along the street and up another, and there in front of them was Godtalk's Head, huge and craggy in that leaden light, with the rain making waterfalls down its face and spraying off its chin. Kit Solent leaned heavily on Fever as they climbed the wooden stairs to the tram platform and went through the gate in the wire fence, which she locked behind them, and then up more stairs to the door in Godtalk's nostril. Fever pounded on the glass with the flat of her hand and left a smeared red handprint there. A shocked face appeared behind the glass and stared at it, and then at her. It was Dr. Isbister, looking like something in an aquarium. "Go away!" he shouted. But other engineers were appearing behind him, and soon Dr. Staling was there, ordering Isbister aside and undoing the heavy bolts. "Thank the gods," said Kit Solent as the doors opened. And if Fever had had gods, she would have thanked them too, for there at Dr. Staling's side was Dr. Crumb. She wanted to run to him. She wanted to hug him. She contented herself with saying, "Greetings, Dr. Crumb, Dr. Staling. The commons are rioting, and Master Solent has kindly brought me home. He is hurt."
"He needs a doctor," said Dr. Isbister,
looking warily at the spreading stain of blood on their visitor's coat.
"I'm fine," Kit insisted. "What I need is to get back to my children. My gods, what if the rioters work out who I am and go to my house?"
He turned back toward the door, but stumbled, and would have fallen if several engineers had not reached out to steady him.
"He must have a doctor," said Dr. Isbister.
"There are no doctors of that sort here," said Dr. Wire. "We must send to the Guild of Physicians in Clerkenwell," Dr. Staling said.
"There is no time," Fever shouted. "Don't you understand? If the men who did this follow us here..."
The engineers flinched at her outburst.
"Your time outside the Head has left you somewhat unreasonable, Miss Crumb," said Dr. Isbister tartly.
But the others seemed to understand her. Sometimes, she thought, it might be allowable to be angry or emotional in order to make people see the urgency of things. She leaned against the stair rail and watched while the engineers barred the doors and helped Kit Solent away, saying, "We must at least clean and bandage that wound before you go." Soon she was left alone with Dr. Crumb. She hadn't noticed until then how hard her heart was pounding, how raggedly she was breathing, how her body still trembled as the terror of the chase shook its way out of her muscles. She looked at Dr. Crumb and said, "Kit took me to Nonsuch House, Godsork's old house on the marshes. And I remembered it." Dr. Crumb tried to keep looking as calm as ever, but the corner of his mouth twitched, and his fingers twined themselves together. "That is impossible," he said. "You were only a few months old when I found you. You could not possibly remember."
"Remember what?" asked Fever.
She knew that she sounded edgy and emotional, but she could not help it. She was edgy and emotional. She said,
"I have some connection with that place, don't I? With Godsork."
"Oh," he said, when he heard that. Another man, less rational, might have said, "Oh, gods! Oh, Poskett! Oh, great Lud!" He hid his eyes for a moment with one hand, then looked at Fever. "Come," he said. Outside, people were moving in small groups onto the stretch of waste ground around Godsork's Head, more and more of them, gathering in the dim and rainy light like crows. Fever followed Dr. Crumb up the stairs, up and up to Dr. Crumb's quarters. She saw as she went in how it had changed. Her things had vanished from the little alcove that had been her bedspace, and there was another workbench there instead. Of course, it was only reasonable that Dr. Crumb should make full use of the space while she was away. So why did the sight of it make her want to cry? Dr. Crumb poured boiled water for them both, from a jug which he kept beside the stove, the water faintly warm as always, and in her own old mug. She clasped her hands around it and drank. She sat on the new workbench, and Dr. Crumb stood facing her. He said, "There are some things which I did not tell you, and some things I told you which were not quite true.
About me? About who I am? What I am?"
"Partly. More about me and what I am." "But I thought you didn't believe in telling lies," said Fever. "Not even white lies."
not even to little girls.
Dr. Crumb looked at the floor, as if he had suddenly become very interested in floors. He took a sip of his boiled water, and began. When Gideon Crumb first came to London, the city was still ruled by the Scriven. There was already talk about rebel outfits called the Skinners' Guilds, and a few anti-Scriven graffitos had been scrawled up on walls in the lower parts of town. But Auric Godshawk still sat on his throne in the Barbican, and Scriven still owned half the city's businesses and all its better property. Gideon grew used to having to stop in his tracks and drop to his knees in the street mud when the chair of some Scriven nobleman was carried past, or risk being beaten by the servants who walked behind it. He grew used, too, to the gales of brutal cheering and jeering that gusted from Pickled Eel Circus, where handsome gladiators like Ted Swiney and slow Loris Dimbolo did battle with each other, and with the weird killing machines which the Scriven pieced together with infinite skill and with no purpose beyond their own cruel amusement. But at least the Scriven's penchant for machines meant that they needed a steady supply of machine builders and machine tenders. That was why they had founded the Order of Engineers. But the Order of Engineers had become more than just machine builders and machine tenders. They had started out by trying to understand ancient devices, and ended up by trying to understand everything. They looked carefully and clearly at the workings of the world. They gathered evidence and made experiments, and developed brilliant theories that they were always ready to abandon if new evidence proved them wrong. They were more than engineers. They had become scientists, and every year they welcomed 20 young men into the Engineerium and started training them to be scientists too. Gideon was one of them, escaping from a childhood in the outlying borough of Lesser Wintermire, with its plashy farms and midgebite fens, its sputtering tallow candles and its vague religious spasms of hope and terror. He did not care who London's rulers were. All his attention was focused on its future, which would be lit by gas and electric and the hard white light of reason. During his first 3 years at the Engineerium, he was an apprentice and lived with other apprentices in a honeycomb of small chambers behind the main building. Their life was simple but comfortable enough. A few of the senior engineers, men like Dr. Staling, shaved their heads and avoided all pleasure, saying that it interfered with the ability to reason. But there were others, like Dr. Wormtimber, who argued that good food, a little drink of an evening, and a comfortable bed helped to relax a man and made it easier for him to think. That attitude appealed to Gideon Crumb, who did not want to shave off his curly nut-brown hair, or stop eating the oat biscuits and apple and bramble pies that reminded him of the nicer bits of his childhood. Of course, he would not go so far as Wormtimber, who had recently moved out of the Engineerium and married an archaeologist's widow. Gideon had always been shy around girls, and had long since decided that romance and marriage and parenthood were things best left to other, less reasonable men. Then, in his fourth year at the Engineerium, everything changed. It was a blue, bitter day, way down in the cheerless deeps of winter, with thick snow heaped along the street sides and weighing down the roofs, and long months to go until spring festival. Gideon, out scouring the dig markets for interesting relics, took a wrong turning down a street he did not recognise, and found himself in the middle of a strange disturbance. An elaborately carved sedan chair had halted in the middle of the street, but although it was so expensive-looking that it could only have belonged to a Scriven, none of the pedestrians around it was kneeling down. When Gideon started to kneel, a man nearby said half-angrily, "Don't you bend your knee to her, mate." He hesitated, knees already awkwardly bent, and looked again at the chair. It was not a true sedan chair at all, but a type of rickshaw with tired wheels at the back where the rear bearer usually walked. In front of it, between its shafts, stood a Jaeger, or Stalker, as Londoners called them. The Scriven had brought several hundred of these reanimated warriors with them when they arrived in the city, but over the years most had gone mad and destroyed themselves, or simply stopped working. The one that had been pulling this chair seemed to have malfunctioned in some critical way. It stood rigidly to attention, but its bulky head twitched restlessly about, and from the mouth slot of its face shield poured a stream of meaningless words. "I am, I was, I what, several, too long, too late, lonely, lonely." "It's gone off its trolley," yelled a barrow boy, and shied a half-brick, which bounced off the Stalker's armour with a clang. The occupant of the chair wound down a tinted window and leaned out, shouting at the Stalker to walk on. Glimpsing her dappled face, Gideon dropped to his knees in the dirty snow. Several of the other onlookers followed suit. If the Stalker came to its senses, the Scriven woman would have it kill anyone who had been disrespectful enough to remain standing in her presence. But the Stalker was too far gone for that. A veteran of the Nomad Empire's long wars, it had finally worn out.
"Sleepy now," it bellowed, and reaching up, caught hold of its own head with both steel hands and wrenched it off in a shower of yellowish sparks and a gurgling of thick fluids. The green light in its eyes faded, and, still holding its head, it toppled over like the statue of a fallen tyrant and lay on the cobbles, trailing thin strings of smoke. For a moment, there was silence. It was so quiet that Gideon could hear the north wind sighing between the icicles that trailed from the eaves above him. For years, hostility to the Scriven had been growing, but this situation was new to everyone, a Scriven alone and defenceless in a St. Kylie street. The Londoners looked at one another, wondering whether they dared take their revenge. Before they could decide, the chair door opened and the Scriven stepped out. She wore a tortoise-shell cat-fur cape with the collar turned up so that all you could see of her was her face. A beautiful face, large-eyed and porcelain-pale, the cheeks and forehead darkly dappled with the Scriven markings. "Move this out of the road," she commanded, pointing one gloved finger at the stalker's wreck. "And take me to the Barbican." None of the watching Londoners moved. How they hated her. You could feel it in the air like a rising mist. That cape she wore cost more than all their houses. The price of those gloves would have fed and clothed their children for a year. And she'd been so sure of herself, with her resurrected heavy to protect her, that she hadn't even brought the Scriven's usual honour guard of thugs and soldiers with her when she ventured through St. Kylie. Someone threw a stone. It wasn't thrown hard, but it struck the Scriven on the side of her perfect face, and she put up a hand to the place where it had hit, and her eyes widened a little, and she seemed at last to understand what danger she was in. "You wouldn't dare," she said. But she didn't sound at all certain about it. "No," said Gideon. Was it really him speaking? It had to be. He could feel his mouth shaping the words and see the breath smouldering in front of his face as he spoke them into the cold, still air. "No, come along, this isn't reasonable. You have nothing to gain by assaulting this person. Do you think the Scriven won't send their mercenaries down here to take revenge if you go any further in this foolishness?" "Who's he?" asked a woman. "No idea," said another. "Engineer, by the look of him." "Blog off, Scriven lover!" yelled a man in the stiff blue overalls of a plastic smith, hefting a cobblestone ready to hurl at the Scriven. But he sounded half-hearted, as if even he could see the sense in what Gideon had said. The stone stayed in his hand, unthrown. Gideon walked past him toward the Scriven. "Thank you," she said thinly, as he drew near to her. Some of the onlookers gasped and murmured. They had never heard a Scriven thank anyone before. She was trembling slightly. How old was she? She didn't look much more than 20, but it was hard to tell with her kind. The joke in London was that if you wanted to know how old a Dapplejack was, you had to cut them in half and count the rings. She reached out and took Gideon by the arm before he could object. "You will lead me to the Barbican, engineer," she said. She didn't have any idea where she was, he realized. Conveyed around London all her life by chair, she knew nothing of the layout of its streets. Whereas he, who had never been able to afford to travel except on foot, could easily get his bearings by glancing up at the temples and buildings whose spires he could see poking up behind the snowy rooftops. A stone flew past him and smashed one of the chair windows. He felt the Scriven woman flinch at the sound of the glass shattering. He flinched too, but he calmed himself by reciting Pi and telling himself that he was doing the only reasonable thing. And arm in arm with the Scriven, he walked up that street and back onto streets he knew, while behind them her would-be murderers contented themselves by making a bonfire of her abandoned chair and smashing the fallen stalker up for spare parts. It was starting to snow again, or perhaps it was just the winter wind lifting flurries of powder snow from the roofs and chimney stacks. The small flakes settled like sequins in the tortoise-shell fur of the Scriven's cape as she and Gideon walked past the lighted windows of exclusive restaurants and high-class scent shops and boutiques until they reached the square in front of the Barbican. Despite the masonry which filled its wheel arches, and the new spires and turrets which spoiled its timber upperworks, the old fortress clearly showed its origins as a huge vehicle, a high-prowed ship of the steppes, in which the Scriven had been dragged halfway across the world by their armies of slaves. Gideon thought his companion might be interested to hear the latest news from the nomad empires, whose technomancers were now fitting engines to their traction fortresses, but just as he was about to mention it, she let go his arm and turned to look at him. Her eyes were the rich brown of expensive chocolate, with some unguessable emotion in them. And suddenly she laughed, and Gideon saw that she wore a metal brace on her teeth. It glittered in the light from the windows of the shops like a tiny railway track. So she wasn't perfect after all. Or at least she must not think that she was perfect, if she had paid some dentist to attach all that careful engineering to her smile.
That was when he fell in love with her. She asked his name before she left him and went up into the barbican. He told her, but he was too startled by his own feelings to ask hers, or ask her what she had been doing in the back streets of St. Kylie all alone. Not until the next morning, when he read the front-page story in The Alarmist, did he learn that Wavy Godsawk, daughter of Auric Godsawk, had been waylaid in the Low City when her malfunctioning Jaeger servant took a wrong turn, and that the Scriven's mercenaries had executed 20 Londoners by way of punishment. Chapter 20. At Nonesuch House. That brief confrontation in St. Kylie, and the Patchwork King's spiteful response, would change the history of London forever. By the summer of that year, few Scriven dared venture far beyond the expensive, well-lit streets that surrounded the Barbican. Those who did were slaughtered by the Skinners' guilds. Brutish reprisals by Godsawk's Suomi mercenaries seemed to have no effect beyond making the commons hate him even more. But Gideon Crumb, safe in the Engineerium, barely noticed any of it. He had never taken an interest in politics, and except for that one morning after he walked Wavy Godsawk home, he avoided newspapers, which everyone knew were unreasonable things, filled with scaremongering and the wildest rumours. He was busy with the study of ancient engines, which he hoped would win him his place as a fully-fledged engineer, and he had no more time for wandering the streets of London. The only trouble was, he could not forget Wavy Godsawk. At night in his bunk while he waited for sleep, when he should have been turning over ideas about torque and fuel efficiency in his mind, he kept being distracted by the image of her face, her smile, her way of speaking. Her voice had been soft but rather deep, he recalled. She had had very small hands. Her hair, or at least those strands of it which had escaped the hood of her cape, was tawny blonde. He told himself not to be so foolish, and forced himself to consider power-weight ratios until he fell asleep. But Wavy Godsawk waited for him in his dreams. It was almost distracting, and almost enough to make him wonder if Dr. Staling didn't have it right when he said that a good engineer must purge himself of all emotions. And then, on a September afternoon when he was puzzling over books in the library, the sounds of uproar and disorder reached him, coming not from distant quarters of the city as they had all summer, but from somewhere inside the Engineerium itself. He closed the book he was reading and hurried out of the library. In the corridor which led to the Engineerium's main entrance, men in the gaudy jackets of Godsawk's private militia were striding about with muskets among a lot of white-coated, kneeling engineers. "Kneel!" one bellowed, seeing Gideon standing there staring, and Gideon knelt. In through the main doors, as if she were solidifying out of a blaze of sunshine, came Wavy Godsawk. The gown she wore was the most unreasonable thing ever seen in the Engineerium. Its skirts whispered along either wall as she passed. Even Dr. Staling, who had often declared that it was irrational and unreasonable to kneel before a scriven, went down on his knees at the sight of her. Gideon, too embarrassed to look at her face, looked at the floor instead. He heard her dress come whispering and sighing and hissing toward him, and then the creak of the huge wicker frame beneath her skirts as she stopped just a few inches away. "I am here on behalf of His Excellency the Civic Commander Auric Godsawk," she said, in that well-remembered voice. "He has sent me here to find an engineer to be his assistant." She paused, and Gideon pictured her looking about at all the kneeling engineers like a lady shopping for new gloves, until he felt her hand touch the back of his bowed head, light as a butterfly. "I think I'd like this one. Have him sent to Nonesuch House this afternoon." There were a lot of men in the order far better qualified than Gideon Crumb to serve as an assistant to the great Scriven inventor. Later there would be all sorts of spiteful rumours about him. The unemotional Dr. Wire grew quite angry that he had not been offered a chance to explore the mysteries of Godsawk's laboratories, and stubbed his toe rather badly when he kicked his workbench in a fit of pique. But Gideon was never aware of that. He must have spent the next few hours gathering his books and belongings, packing clean shirts and underwear, and travelling somehow to Bankmanside and out along the causeway. But when he thought back on it in after years, it seemed to him that he had gone straight from kneeling before Wavy Godsawk in the Engineerium to kneeling before her father in the hallway of Nonesuch House, watching Godsawk's slippers and the hems of Godsawk's robes as the tyrant inventor paced toward him. "Get up." Gideon climbed to his feet, still too nervous to look directly at his new employer. He glimpsed peacock-coloured robes, a speckled hand gripping the handle of a steel cane, a lot of rings, a crisp white cuff. The voice said, "Why should you kneel to me, Londoner? There are thousands of your kind in this city, and barely 200 of mine. The time of the Scriven will soon be over." Gideon couldn't help but look up at that. Except for a strange, half-mocking smile, Godsork's face was the same face that Gideon remembered from 1,000 wall posters and from the immense statue which was being built in the west of the city. A long, angular face, leopard-speckled, white-bearded, white-maned, the large, watchful eyes of a big and dangerous cat.
"I've shocked you, eh?" he said. "You've never heard one of the Scrivener's chosen people speak the truth about ourselves that way. Well, I'll go further. There is no Scrivener. There is no real difference between us and any other race of human beings. Our longevity, and these attractive marks of which we are so proud, are just minor genetic quirks. Fate has blessed us with robust constitutions and an interesting skin complaint, and in every other way we are as human as you. We managed to grow powerful for a while, but we have not done much with that power. We played games, like children, imagining that the real business of our kind all lay ahead. Now playtime is nearly over, and we see that there is nothing more to come. That's why I must work fast, if I am to leave the world anything to remember us by. So I need an assistant. My daughter tells me that you did her a service once, and those fools at the Engineerium assure me you are clever.
"What would you have me do, sir?" asked Dr. Crumb, excited at the thought of working on one of the old Scriven's inventions. But by way of answer, Godsork merely led him to a side room and flung the door open. It was a big room, and it was filled from side to side and floor to ceiling with old tech. There were big pieces and small, well-preserved ones, along with a few that were no more than hunks of rust.
"I need money, Crumb. I have a project in mind, and it must be funded, so I have decided to sell off my collection. This lot has been acquired over a lifetime, and I have had a long life. I can't remember what's in here myself, so I want you to catalogue it and assess it as you go. Sort the trash from the treasures. Make notes. If you need anything, ask my daughter. I'll pop in from time to time and see how you're doing."
"I'll do my best, sir," said Gideon. But Godsork had already gone striding on his way. Days went by. Weeks went by. Slowly Gideon worked his way through the mountains of machinery, studying, describing, puzzling. Had this battered plastic frame been part of a TV set, or only a window? Could this crushed orange rubber ball really have hopped into space, as its name suggested? He made drawings and notes in a circular ledger. He grew bored. He thought often of asking Godsork to release him from this work, which any half-trained scavenger could have done, and let him return to the Engineerium. But he never did. At the Engineerium, he would not be near Wavy Godsork. Wavy worked as her father's assistant. When she was in that role, she wore her hair tied back and put on a white coat, tailored to spread over the wide bell of her skirts. Each afternoon she would come in and listen carefully while Gideon explained the more interesting pieces he had found and catalogued. She dropped in with questions and suggestions, always perfectly timed. She set him thinking. She challenged his assumptions. The Order had taught him that women were weak, unreasonable creatures, but Wavy was neither. The scriven dapplings on her face and neck made chains of little V-shapes like wild geese flying. He imagined mathematical formulae that might describe the angle of her cheekbones. Chapter 21. Nocturne in Blue. In the summertime, some of the objects that Gideon had studied were shipped north to the city to be sold at auction in the tech exchange, and the rest were cleared into a smaller room, for none such house was to host a party. As Lord of London, Godsork was expected to be hospitable. His Suomi mercenaries went to and fro along the causeway, checking for booby traps and clearing stands of trees where Skinner terrorists might lurk. Canopies and marquees flowered on Godsork's lawns, and famous scent artists like Eldritch Hooter and Odorita arrived to load the scent lanterns with their specially composed perfumes. Gideon's work languished as the day of the party drew near. Godsork seemed to have forgotten all about the remainder of his collection, and even Wavy stopped visiting, spending her afternoons instead trying on dresses with the help of a new slave girl her father had bought for her in the city. Gideon sat in his room thinking about her, listlessly trying to concentrate on his notes and drawings, distracted by the tuning up of power shawms and pneumatic sack butts in the bandstand below his window. He wasn't invited to the party, of course. But nor was he forbidden from attending, and when the whole of Nonsuch House was filled with revellers and rowdy as a St. Kylie boozer, there was not much else that he could do. He wandered through the crowded rooms, listening to the music and sniffing the rich odours that unfurled from the scent lanterns. Wavy had told him that her people could see scents, and had spoken passionately about the great perfume symphonies of Hooter, Klopstock and De Vries, which to her were not just smells but shimmering, luminous fields of subtle colour. Gideon tried to imagine what that would be like, but he couldn't. The scents just made him sneeze. He swiped a glass from a passing waiter's tray and wandered on, ignored by the scriven, who shouted small talk at one another over his head.
"Hooter's in good form. What does he call this scent?"
"I think it's Nocturne in Blue."
"Did you hear about Stefan d'Estria? The Skinner's got him, laid in wait for him by his own gate."
"Disgraceful. Godsawk must do something to discipline these monkeys." The scriven men wore stack-heeled boots and pearl-studded evening coats. The ladies in their vast skirts looked like mythical creatures, half woman, half sofa. Wavy Godsawk glided by, heading to the dance floor, arm in arm with some old scriven lord. Her face was lifted toward her partner's, and her eyes were smiling, but she kept her mouth closed, and Gideon knew that it was because she felt self-conscious about the brace on her teeth. She was the most beautiful thing he had ever seen.
"There goes Odo Bolventor with the Godsawk girl," said a scriven, leaning over Gideon's shoulder to point out the couple to his friend.
"I hear Godsawk's been trying to arrange a marriage. He needs an heir."
"And Bolventor needs her dowry. He calls himself Margrave of Thurrock, but he's as poor as a gnat."
They moved on, still gossiping, never realizing that they had just squashed Gideon's dreams. He pushed his way out of the room. He did not want to watch Wavy dancing with her Margrave. He went out into the gardens, glad to be away from the heat and noise of the party and the cloying odours of the scent lanterns. He walked past the ghostly marquees, past the gangs of servants who were busy lighting float lamps and setting them adrift upon the evening air. The sounds of music and chit-chat faded as he went downhill toward the still lagoons.
"Having fun, Dr. Crumb?"
There were statues among the shrubbery. As Gideon turned to see who'd spoken, one of them seemed to come to life. Auric Godsawk strolled toward him, the night wind flipping the skirts of his printed silk evening gown. There was a glass of brandy in his hand. It slopped and glittered as he gestured uphill toward the house.
"They make a racket, don't they? Parties are meant for the young, not old men like me."
"Yes, sir." He came closer, peering at Gideon's face in the light of the moon, which hung low and yellowish above the hill.
"You look crushed, Crumb, like a well-trodden biscuit. What's wrong?"
"Nothing, sir," said Gideon. He wondered if the old scriven understood what he felt for Wavy. He said, "Sir, do you think that some of my fellow engineers are right when they say that emotion should be avoided, that we must suppress all feelings if we are to be truly rational?" Godsawk looked surprised, the way that people generally do when you ask them philosophical questions in shrubberies in the middle of the night. He snorted and took another sip of his brandy.
"I don't know about that, Crumb. We scriven have always been very keen on emotions, sensations, feelings, that sort of thing. We live only once, and we might as well enjoy all the pleasures that the old world has to offer us on our journey through it."
"But emotions are so painful," said Gideon. He felt as if he were confessing, "I am in love with your daughter." He felt sure the old scriven must understand him. Godsawk nodded, looking out over the lagoons. Lanterns drifted above the water, and beyond the marshes the lights of London twinkled in the mist.
"Yes, pain's a part of it," he said. "When we see something beautiful, we want to possess it. But we know we can't, don't we? And that hurts. Beauty fades, things change, time moves us on."
He drained his glass and raised it to Gideon before throwing it aside. Then, reaching inside his robes, he took out a small silver case.
"Look at this," he said.
He flipped it open. Inside, on the crumpled silk lining, lay a shining thing of polished steel, or maybe some other alloy that no one any longer knew a name for, something from the ancient world. Godsawk took it out, holding it carefully between the tips of his forefinger and thumb. Just a wee thing it was, the shape of a walnut, the size of an almond.
"Look at this, Crumb. In theory, a man's whole life could be recorded in a seed like this, all his hopes and loves and fears, and all his knowledge."
Gideon looked at the object and wondered what Godsawk expected him to say.
"I see," he murmured at last, trying to sound impressed, but fearing he sounded merely foolish.
Godsawk chuckled for no reason that Gideon could understand. He snapped the case shut and put it back in whatever inner pocket it had come from. The moon had risen higher and shone ghostly in the garden's mysterious pools.
"It's a pretty world," he said. "What a pity we scriven won't inherit it. And now I must return to my guests. They'll probably expect a speech or some such nonsense. Don't stay out here in the cold too long, Dr. Crumb. Back to bed with you and get some sleep."
But Gideon knew that sleep would be impossible. The party was set to go on all night.
He walked along the water's edge, all the way around the hill. Long after midnight, he started to climb back up the terraces. Glass broke somewhere nearby, a small prickling sound. He looked toward the summer house and saw a movement there, went closer and heard the sound of soft sobs. Someone weeping.
Wavy?
He recognized her dress in the summer house dark. She stood with her back to him, a hand raised to her face. The shards of a glass glittered on the floor nearby. She held a little jar in her hand. As he watched, she upended it, tipping out some of its contents onto a lint pad. Then she went on rubbing her face.
"Miss Godshawk," he said.
She turned with a little gasp.
"What are you doing here?" she asked.
Her words wobbled in the middle and blurred at the edges. She was a little drunk, and he thought she had been crying. And then, as he went toward her, he saw that the markings on her face had gone. He thought at first that it must be a trick of that dim light, but it was not. Those scriven stains which had showed so strikingly on her forehead and high cheekbones and along the curve of her jaw had been washed away.
"You are not really a scriven," he said. "Of course I'm a scriven, you fool," replied Wavy Godshawk.
The soft, consoling scent of the cream she'd used to clean her face came wafting toward him. She threw the wet lint pad on the floor.
"I'm as much a scriven as he is. Look!"
And she came closer to Gideon and twisted her head and lifted her hair to show him a sepia patch on the side of her neck.
"Look!"
She tore open her lace collar and undid the top two buttons of her bodice and pulled it open to show him another speckle, black in the moonlight, which lay in the hollow above her collarbone like a pool of ink.
"Not good enough for Odo Bolventor," she said nastily. "Odo Bolventor, Margrave of Thurrock. Margrave of Puke. I'm better without him. To think I would have married him."
Gideon took a nervous step away from her, alarmed by the unsettling impulses that were telling him to go closer. Wavy had always seemed to him so haughty and so self-assured. He would never have imagined that she would behave in such an emotional, undignified way, and in front of a mere human like him. He said awkwardly,
"I don't understand." "Of course you don't. How could you understand? You're just a dull old Homo sapiens, and I am scriven."
She lifted her head, tilting her pale chin proudly at him. Her dress rustled. Beneath the silk, stays and corsets, the stiff wicker frame that gave her skirt its shape creaked softly in time to her hurried breathing. Then, turning away, she said weepily,
"I was born like this. Some scriven are nowadays. Our race is failing. I have a few markings, but not many, and none on my face. When I was little, the other girls used to say that the scrivener ran out of ink when he came to write on me. So I used makeup. Wendigo's patent body ink. I spray it on through a stencil mask, so my marks always look the same. But Scriven Society is such a small world, and there is so much gossip, that of course the Margrave came to hear of it. Tonight, while we were dancing, he asked me if it was true, and when I said it was, he said he would not be made a fool of, and would not marry a freak and risk having his sons born blank like me. He said I was as ugly as boiled fish."
Gideon wanted to say, "You aren't ugly." He wanted to tell her how beautiful she was. But instead he said,
"Your father says that the time of the scriven is over. Perhaps it will be an advantage to have no speckles, which would show what you are to the commons."
"The commons," said Wavy dismissively, and then looked up at him as if she had remembered something.
"It was you who saved me from them, that day in the city."
She laughed, a soft, wondering laugh.
"Why did you do that?"
"I don't know," said Gideon, truthfully. A floating lantern drifted past, and its light came through the glass roof and brushed Wavy's face. She smiled, sudden and bewitching. "I don't believe I ever thanked you," she said. "We can be so thoughtless, can't we Homo superiors?" She took his hands and drew him close to her. She smelled of wine and cosmetics. Her breath felt hot against his face.
"Why are you shaking like that?" she asked. "What is your name, anyway? I can't just call you Dr. Crumb." "I'm Gideon," he managed to say.
"Then thank you, Gideon," she said. And at last she kissed him, and her lips were parted, and the wires of the brace on her teeth gently grazed his mouth.
Chapter 22. The Fifth Word. It had not lasted, of course. A love affair between a Londoner and a scriven. It had not lasted out the month. But for a while the whole balance of Gideon's life had shifted. Instead of reason, he was guided by the unfathomable feelings that Wavy aroused in him. He neglected his work and sat waiting for her brief, stolen visits.
He once or twice considered writing poems. He didn't know if she loved him as much as he loved her, or if he was just a distraction for her. At night, sometimes, while the rest of the house slept, he would go quietly out into the gardens, and she would be waiting for him in their summer house. Goldsork must never know of this, she said, holding him in her strong, speckled arms. But Goldsork knew almost everything that went on in his house. He had been suspicious of his daughter's reasons for choosing Gideon ever since the young engineer arrived. That new slave girl he had bought her was his spy. One afternoon, in the middle of a hissing storm of cold grey rain, Gideon was called before him. The great man was waiting for him in the vault beneath the house, a place that Gideon had never visited before. It seemed devoted to the study of stalkers. Dozens stood or lay about like charmless statues with their heads prized open. In the vats that lined the walls floated dead people, or at least Gideon hoped they were dead. Severed heads in jars lined a shelf behind Godsork's desk, and the glare that the inventor shot at him as he came in made Gideon fear for a moment that his own would shortly join them. "Do you take me for a fool, Crumb?" the inventor asked. "No, sir." Gideon looked for help. In a corner of the room stood Wavy Godsork. Her face was stenciled with its familiar markings, that flock of wild geese on her brow and cheeks. He remembered how closely and solemnly she had watched him as they lay together in the summer house amid the shipwreck of her dress. Now she would not even look at him, just stared haughtily at the ceiling. "Did you think I wouldn't find out about your little romance?" asked Godsork.
"No, sir," said Gideon. "I thought..."
"Thought what? That I'd approve? Great scrivener! Women of childbearing age are in short enough supply among my people as it is, without I go marrying one off to you."
"But..."
"You wretch, Crumb! If I weren't kinder than most of my breed, you'd be dead by now, or on your way to meet the death machines at Pickledeel Circus. As it is, I want you gone." "What, do you think I won't be able to find another little scribbler like you to aid me in my work? You're nothing. If you come near Nonesuch House again, I'll set the dogs on you. Now go."
Gideon looked again at Wavy, but Wavy was still not looking at him. She seemed bored. The next thing he remembered was the huge front door of Nonesuch House slamming shut behind him, leaving him alone on the drive in the pounding rain. Twilight was coming on. He was already soaked. He looked at the windows above him, hoping to see Wavy look out. Godsork would have ordered her not to, but she would take no notice of Godsork, would she? He waited, while rain trickled down the back of his neck and crept in through the seams of his sleeves and plastered his wet hair across his face and filled up his boots. But he never saw her again. 6 months later, he would stand once more in Godsork's garden. It was a few weeks after the Skinners riots, and a story had been doing the rounds about how a band of Scriven had been found holed up at Nonesuch House, and how the Skinners had gone there and slaughtered them. Gideon had not let himself think about Wavy Godsork since he returned to London the previous summer. He had gone back to the Engineerium, and Dr. Staling had allowed him to pick up his studies. When thoughts of Wavy came into his mind, he forced them away and made himself concentrate on his work instead. He had worked hard all winter at forgetting her, and he had grown good at it. But when the riots started, he could think of nothing but Wavy. On the evening when it began, he was outside the Engineerium, assaying circuit boards for a digger in Womblesden. Hurrying home, he stopped to watch the Skinners running down Cripplegate in the summer twilight. The smack of their shoes on the cobbles sounded like applause. Some stopped just long enough to hurl burning brands in through the windows of shops and banking houses. They carried things he thought were banners, until one passed close by and he saw that it was the flayed skin of a scriven. From Ludgate Hill came the crackling brush-fire sound of muskets. In some ways it was almost a relief. The anger of London had been building for so long it had been like living on the flanks of a volcano. Now that the eruption had finally come, there was no time to worry about it, no time to think. Crumb hid among some bins near the tram terminus to avoid another gang of Skinners, and was then almost shot down as a Skinner himself when he rounded a corner near the Engineerium and came upon a battalion of the Scriven's mercenaries, their crisp white uniforms smudged with soot and powder. Luckily, the Scriven officer in charge of them recognised him from his Nonesuch House days and ordered them not to shoot. "What is happening?" Gideon asked him, as he was bundled through the lines. "Where is Godsork?"
"Safe in the Barbican, Doctor, waiting for us to finish off this London rabble."
"What about his daughter?"
"Scrivener alone knows. These mobs are everywhere. Get back to your Engineerium, man. You'll be safe there."
But next morning, the mobs broke into the Engineerium itself, smashing and looting, shouting that the engineers were Scriven lackeys and no better than their masters. The frightened and bewildered engineers were herded out into the courtyard, and there they might all have been killed, except that a second, larger band of Skinners happened by. They were led by a man named Creech, who scrambled up on an overturned sedan chair and fired his spring gun in the air to call for quiet. He wore a leather apron smeared with brown and crimson stains, and stuck through his belt was a long curved blade like a shard of the moon. But it turned out that in this mob he was the voice of reason. "These men are our kind," he shouted, pointing at the captive engineers. "We got no argument with them. This place of theirs will make good homes for human widows and human orphlings. You want to do some killing, you better come with me. Godzork himself is still holding out in the barbican." The Skinners went roaring off, leaving the engineers to pick up the pieces of their smashed experiments and try to salvage their scattered and damaged books. Pickled Eel Circus was blazing like a colossal brazier, sending thick swathes of smoke across the engineerium compound. More rioters passed, and this time many of them wore once white uniforms. The Scriven's mercenary soldiers had decided that the fight could not be won, and were changing sides. A few hours later, the engineers heard the cheering spread from the barbican all through the city, as word came that Auric Godzork had been killed. But surely Wavy's blank, unspeckled skin would have saved her. Gideon kept thinking about her all through the confused days which followed the riots, while he helped the Order to move to their new home in the abandoned head of Godzork's giant statue. As he wheeled the engineer's belongings on handcarts down the Westerway, he was watched by severed Scriven heads, which the Skinners had stuck on the railings outside the houses there. None of them was Wavy's. But how could he know that hers was not among the flayed bodies that lay in the gutters, attracting the attentions of rats and ravens and stray dogs? Oh, surely, he thought, when she heard the rioters coming, she would have had the sense to wipe her false markings off and mingle with the mobs. But Wavy wasn't logical. She had her prickly Scriven pride, and he could well imagine her stenciling darker markings on just to taunt the Skinners. When he neared Nonsuch Hill that morning, he saw that the house he had known so well was scorched and tumbled. Charred grass crumbled into ash as he climbed the terraces. A film of soot lay on the surface of the pools. The blackened roof beams ticked softly, embers glowing red as the breeze fanned them. Metal had melted and flowed in silvery puddles and lacings over the blackened tiles underfoot. "Wavy," called Gideon, over the cawing of the carrion birds. He started looking for her among the crumpled outbuildings, hoping that she might have hidden somehow, but all he found were the dead. Whether Wavy was among them or not, it was impossible to know. They all looked like heather roots, scorched by a brush fire. It was on his way back to London that day that Gideon decided to turn off his feelings. He had seen for himself now how dangerous emotions were. Tenderness and anger, love and hate, they all led to nothing but trouble. He blamed them for his own broken heart, as well as the feverish violence of the Skinners' guilds. He was not an animal. From now on, he decided, he would live without feelings. Looking carefully at himself in the speckled mirror which hung from a nail on his workspace wall, Gideon shaved his head and gathered up the pile of chestnut curls and carried them to the stove and threw them in and watched them burn. It was a few weeks later that a note arrived in the careful, childish writing of Chigley Unthank, asking him to come and assess a new dig far out on the marshes. Dr. Crumb remembered Unthank, an archaeologist who had worked for Godzork and been a frequent visitor to Nonsuch House. Now he was an outcast, scratching a living for himself and his daughter in the brick marsh. His note claimed he had unearthed the fragments of an ancient computer brain, but when Gideon reached the place, Unthank could only show him a few scraps of ruined circuit board, lashed together with wire and strung with animal bones, a common tribal totem from the time of the downsizing. When Dr. Crumb explained patiently that such things could be dug up almost anywhere and were of no use except as an illustration of how far mankind had sunk into savagery and superstition after the fall of the ancient world, Master Unthank had grown embarrassed, and even Gideon could tell that the tale of the computer brain had been just a ruse to bring him there. Nervously, almost shyly, Unthank beckoned him into the miserable little smoke-filled scrap plastic hut that was his home. His daughter Katie, a scruffy-looking teenager, was scrubbing circuit shards in a tub of muddy water. Beside the fire a basket lay, and in the basket was a child, kicking its legs, jerking its tiny fists about. It stared up at Gideon with odd-coloured eyes. "Woman brought it here soon after the riots," said Unthank from the doorway. "She kept her face hid, wouldn't give her name. Said she had to go on a journey and couldn't take the kid. Said I was to send word for you." "Why me?" asked Gideon. Unthank did not reply. His daughter had stopped scrubbing and was watching Gideon curiously, as if waiting to see what he would do. Gingerly he reached into the basket and lifted the luggage label that was tied around the child's wrist. He knew the handwriting at once. Wavy Godsork had been her father's assistant for a long time. Each drawer and library shelf at Nonsuch House had been labelled in the same careful script that he saw on that brown paper tag in the smoky light of Unthank's hut. There were just five words. Her name is Fever Crumb. Chapter 23 Under Siege.
"Then you are my father?" asked Fever when he had told her everything. She was shocked, of course, terribly shocked and disappointed that Dr. Crumb had ever given in to such fervid and unreasonable emotions. And there was another feeling in her, too, a quivering, fluttering feeling that arose at the thought that he really was her father. But feelings did not matter. They were a distraction. All that mattered now was finding out the truth. "That's what she meant, isn't it? Her name is Fever Crumb. Wavy Godsork was my mother, and she was saying that you were my father."
Dr. Crumb looked away toward the rain-wet windows and the city outside them. He set down the cup he had been holding, and the sound made Fever start. "You are her child, of that I'm sure. It has always been thought that Homo sapiens and Homo superior could not have children together."
"But perhaps Wavy was not like other Scriven," suggested Fever. "She had hardly any markings. Or perhaps Godsork was telling you the truth, and there was never as much difference between us and them as they liked to claim."
"Both those things are possible," admitted Dr. Crumb. "But we have no evidence. All I know is that the label was in Wavy's handwriting and that it said her name is Fever Crumb. At the time, I thought she had just written that to make me think that you were mine, hoping that would make me take care of you. I didn't mind. I would have taken care of you anyway. It was the only reasonable thing to do. But later, as you grew, you seemed so like me in so many ways that I began to wonder if you might be mine after all." Fever went to the mirror on the wall which she had stood before so often to shave her head. She could see herself reflected there, and Dr. Crumb behind her. She saw now that they had the same narrow faces, the same sticky-out ears. But she hadn't inherited his small mouth or long nose. Her mouth and nose were echoes of another face, the face of Wavy Godsork.
"Didn't you try to find her?" she asked. "After you'd found me, I mean. After you knew she must still be alive."
Dr. Crumb shook his head.
"It was impossible, Fever. I had no way of knowing which way she had fled. North, south, east, or west. I had no contacts outside London whom I could ask about a fugitive Scriven. And if I did ask, and they had seen her, I might only have caused her to be recognised and killed. For all I know, she died in the marshes somewhere after she left you at Unthank's hut. The Skinners still had patrols and watchers out there. She vanished, Fever. She was swallowed up by history, and we shall probably never know what became of her. I'm just glad that at least I have you."
"The other engineers, Dr. Staling, do they know all this?" Dr. Crumb shook his head.
"I've always told them what I told you, that I found you in a basket on the marsh."
Fever kept looking at herself. Half Scriven, she thought. Wavy's daughter. Godsork's granddaughter. She said,
"There's more. I remember things. Things that happened before I was born. Things that only Godsork could have seen."
Dr. Crumb frowned.
"Some sort of inherited memory? It does not sound likely."
Something slammed against Godsork's head with a sound like a huge bell ringing. Dr. Crumb went to the window.
"There is a mob out there," he said.
Fever joined him, looking down. The rain had slackened, but an ominous end-of-the-world gloom still hung over the abandoned factories. A tide of people was flooding onto the wasteland that surrounded Godsork's head. Sedan chairs bobbed upon it, and burning torches made bright points of saffron light behind the rain. Those at the front of the crowd were throwing things, and a few of them threw hard enough to hit the head. Tiles and half-bricks clanged and sang against the metal, and from some neighbouring room came the clash of a smashed window. Fever and Dr. Crumb ran from his quarters and down the stairs. Down on the library level they met Dr. Staling and some others coming up.
"The Commons have surrounded us," said Staling. "It's like the Skinner's riots come again. But there is no call for alarm, gentlemen, or, Fever. I have switched on the intruder cuter. That should hold the troublemakers at bay."
From outside came cries and curses, accompanied by flutterings of hard blue light. The engineers had not forgotten the attack on their old premises, and they had taken measures to defend their new home. The high fence which ringed the head was wired to electric pile in the basement, and at the first sign of the rioters attacking, Dr. Staling had turned it on. Once a few of the roughs outside had been blasted by the powerful current, the rest drew back, scared of the order's magic and content to hurl stones and insults up at Godsork's impassive face.
"Scriven lovers!" "Send out the patchskin maid! Throw her out, or we'll climb up and get her!"
Their words came thinly into the head. Fever listened and tried not to tremble.
"I should go out there," she said. "That would be the most logical thing. If I give myself up, they might leave the head alone. The survival of the Order is more important than the survival of me."
"Nonsense," said Master Isbister hotly.
"Give you up to those unreasoning brutes," said Dr. Staling. "Never."
A movement on the stairs behind her made Fever start and turn, but it was only Kit Solent, still pale and weak-looking, with Dr. Pither hurrying behind him, saying,
"You should not try to move, Solent. You will open the wound again. You should rest until we can find you a physician."
Kit waved him away. "Fever, you're all right." Fever nodded, but could not take her eyes off his blood-stained coat.
"Don't worry about me," he told her. "I can look after myself. I'm going to try and get back to Ludgate Hill."
"Impossible," said Dr. Staling. "The head is surrounded, and if we switch off the intruder-cutor, that rabble will be over it in a jiffy."
"But, Doctor, I must try. My son and daughter."
"Oh, be reasonable, man. You'll be no use to your children dead. Even if you did get out, that rabble would tear you to pieces. They've seen you with fever, remember, or their leaders have. You would never make it to Ludgate Hill."
A fresh surge of shouting and cheering came from outside. A barrage of stones rattled like hail against Godsawk's face. Even if Kit had tried to argue with the old engineer, he would never have made himself heard. Dr. Staling waited patiently for the din to subside, then went on.
"There is only one thing to do. We must get you and Fever to safety. Once they see that you're gone, the mob will lose interest in this place. There is little loot in it, apart from books, and they do not look like bookish types. I shall send someone to fetch those children of yours, Solent, and you can return as soon as these riots are over."
"But when will that be?" demanded Kit.
"And where shall we hide in the meantime?"
"I believe Dr. Collyhold's balloon is airworthy," said Staling. "The wind is from the southwest today. It'll carry you north, where help will be waiting for you."
"What help?" asked Dr. Crumb.
"The movement," said Dr. Staling, glancing about fiercely to quell the startled murmuring of his engineers. "Yes, gentlemen, I have been in contact with agents of the movement."
"You're in league with those nomadic ruffians?"
cried Griffin Wire, aghast.
"I have talked with their agents," said Staling calmly, "and I do not believe they are ruffians. They respect knowledge far more than most Londoners. Their entire society is based upon the application of technology. I have received overtures of friendship from their leader, Land Admiral Quercus, who has given me to understand that once he controls London, we engineers shall be given the status of a guild. We shall be consulted by our new rulers and allowed a seat on council alongside the guilds of surgeons and wig-makers and perfumiers."
The engineers started to brighten at that, but the boom of some heavy object crashing against the outside of the head reminded them of their predicament.
"How long before these friends of yours arrive?" asked Kit Solent.
Dr. Staling shook his head thoughtfully.
"They're coming to London because of the technology we possess. They have been waiting beyond the motorway while their agents make contact with various important persons, such as myself, in the hope that they might achieve a peaceful takeover. But their patience has its limits, and once they learn that riots have broken out, I should imagine they will move fast to secure the city. I would expect them in a day or so, no more. Until then, you and Fever will be safe in their convoy. They will have surgeons there who can attend to your injury."
"And the children?" asked Kit.
"I shall send Dr. Crumb to make sure that they are safe," the chief engineer promised.
"Why me?"
asked Dr. Crumb.
"You are our childcare expert, Crumb."
"But I must go with Fever."
"Impossible," cried Dr. Collyhole, who had been fluttering nervously behind Dr. Staling all through his talk.
"My balloon will not lift more than two persons. Indeed, we do not know for certain that it will lift anyone at all. I had planned to make the first ascent myself. I would not feel easy in myself in trusting the lives of Fever and Master Solent to such an untested device."
"It seems we have no choice, Doctor," said Kit Solent, smiling weakly at him. "I do not think that your electrified fence will hold off that mob outside for long. Those people out there don't think like engineers. They are barely thinking at all. Once they've worked themselves up into enough of a rage, they'll find a way in here, even if they have to bridge the fence with their own dead. I don't like Dr. Staling's plan much, but I can't think of another."
Dr. Staling nodded, pleased that Kit had given in to reason.
"As soon as this mob disperses," he promised, "I shall go straight to the movement's chief agent, a woman named Madame Lakshmi, who has a tower in the Astrologer's Quarter. She is in possession of a remarkable piece of old technology that enables her to communicate with our friends in the north. I shall ask her to warn them that you are on your way. Well, gentlemen?"
The engineers stood gazing at him. They were men of thought, not action.
"Come on," urged Dr. Staling, starting to lead them up the stairs. "Come on, we have a balloon to fill."
They started after him, up toward Collyhole's attic. Soon Fever and Dr. Crumb were left alone, except for Dr. Isbister, who had never placed any credence in either the intruder-cuter or old Collyhole's dreams of flight, and intended to stand guard over his precious library. Fever knew she should be concerned at Dr. Staling's scheme. She could already see a dozen flaws in it, but her mind was too numb. She had come through so much madness that day that a little more seemed to make no difference. Why not take Dr. Collyhole's air balloon, if that was the only way to leave? Why not seek shelter with the movement, if there was none to be found in London? But there were things she needed to do before she left. She pointed toward the library doors. "Dr. Isbister, don't we have some of Godsork's notebooks in the collection?"
"We do," admitted the librarian. "But this seems hardly the moment."
Fever turned to Dr. Crumb. "Perhaps one of them contains something about what he did to me." "But Fever," he said, "we have so little time." "It will take at least an hour to fill Dr. Collyhole's balloon," Fever reasoned. "I would rather spend that time in the search for knowledge than sit listening to them." The sound of the crowd outside rose to a bullish roar as she spoke. Then it died away. A single voice bellowed angry words that Fever could not make out. Some tub-thumper, she guessed, rousing them for another onslaught on the fence.
"Please, Dr. Crumb," she begged. "I remember such strange things. I thought I was going mad, but now I think... now I don't know what to think."
"As long as you are thinking, Fever," said Dr. Crumb warningly. "As long as you are not giving in to emotion." But she could tell he was wavering. "I am sure Dr. Isbister will not approve of us rummaging through his collection," he said.
"Oh, nobody takes any notice of Dr. Isbister, it seems," said the librarian peevishly,
and waved them toward the library's tall doors. Chapter 24 The Library. Through the crowds outside, an old-fashioned sedan chair came creeping. It was heavy and richly ornamented, and needed four bearers to carry it along. Ted Swiney, who was standing up on the roof of another chair with Charlie at his side, shouted, "Let them through! Make way there! Let him through!" The crowd eddied, jostling Swiney's chair and making Charlie fearful that he'd fall from it and end up trampled. But the mob were just obeying Ted's orders, pushing aside to let the big chair through. Its bearers set it down, and Thaniel Wormtimber stepped out of it, blinking in the glare of the torches which men held up all round him.
"Is all this trouble you're doing, Master Swiney?"
the master of London's devices grumbled, squinting upward through the rain.
"I didn't rouse this lot up," said Ted. "But now they're roused, I mean to make sure they keep on seeing me as their mate, and you'll do the same if you're wise."
He shouted to the crowd.
"Here we go, mates. This here is Master Wormtimber, our master of devices. One of the few men on the new council who still cares how us commoners feel. That's why I sent for him. He's brought us what we need to winkle the patch-skin maid and her cronies out of that head."
Wormtimber slipped a satchel from his shoulder and passed it up to Ted, who held it high.
"This is old tech," bellowed Ted. "With what's in here, our new Skinner can finish his work."
He pushed the satchel at Charlie. His face, with its eyebrows scorched off, looked more furious than ever.
"Go on, then. Take it."
Charlie took the satchel from him and peeked inside. Folded paper, thick and white. The bag was stuffed with paper boys.
"What do you want me to do, Ted?"
asked Charlie, feeling scared of Ted, of the crowd, of the magic fence that ringed the head, scared of everything.
"Use it," said Ted, sounding fierce but smiling as he spoke, because he wouldn't want to let the crowd see him treating Bagman Creech's heir as if he were a common potboy.
He looped the satchel's strap over Charlie's head and seized him under both arms, swinging him down off the chair roof. Charlie never quite reached the ground. Other hands took hold of him, lifting him high. He was passed from man to man across the crowd's heads until he reached its edge, where they set him down, cheering him, thumping him between the shoulder blades. Ahead, a few score yards of sodden mud and rubble lay between him and the engineer's fence. The weeds that had grown there had been tramped flat by the crowd earlier, and the air was filled with the salady scent of their crushed stalks.
"Three cheers for the Skinner!"
shouted a voice behind him, Ted's, and three great waves of sound rolled and broke against the giant metal face that towered above him. Charlie looked up at it. He thought of the girl with odd eyes, and imagined her crouching inside, terrified and doomed. "Well, serve her right," he told himself. "Best get it over with." He undid the fastenings of the satchel. Then he ran at the fence, and just before he reached it, flung the satchel as hard and as high as he could. He almost overbalanced as he let it go, almost reached out and grabbed those deadly wires, but he saved himself just in time.
The bag landed with a dull flump among the weeds and rubbish between the timber props which supported Godshawk's massive chin. A half-dozen white shapes spilled out like dropped sandwiches. They lay there for a moment. Then, with furtive, papery motion,